we're going to listen to a show on Gaia called Targeted Disinformation. Now, this guy, Richard Doughty, first saw him on a Stephen Greer production. If you don't know who Dr. Stephen Greer is, he's a medical doctor that became a UFOologist. He's got a pretty good messages of unity, getting your shit together, and so that the aliens will come down and actually deal with us rather than us being murderous monkeys. One thing I've noticed about him, he tends to do his background on people. And so he doesn't have people on unless they can prove who they are. And he had this guy, Richard Doughty. He's a former OSI, Office of Special Investigations for the Air Force. And we're going to listen to him talk about some of the secret shit he was dealing with within the military. But the shit makes you think. You know, we don't know what the government's up to. They're lying to us constantly. They don't have our interests in mind. They have theirs. Right? They're no longer for the people. They're for themselves. So we're going to listen to this, and we're going to talk about it afterwards.
Today, on Disclosure, we're with Richard Doughty, a retired special agent who served in the Air Force Office of Special Investigations and was intimately involved with UFO ET-related content. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you.
So while you were in the OSI, did you see any evidence of a secret space program?
Yes. I was briefed into one. It was called Gamma Sling, Project Gamma Sling. And the program centered around guarding the Earth and guarding our solar system from dangers from either asteroids or extraterrestrial hostile entities. And the first spacecraft that was launched in accordance with Gamma Sling was in 1980. It was launched into an orbit near Mars. And the ironic thing about it is Voyager was launched in 1977, with Voyager 1 and 2, and both those Voyagers actually mask the launch of the secret craft, highly secret craft, to be orbited around Mars.
What else can you tell us about that? Were there any probes sent out as well?
Yeah, there's a lot of probes, many probes. Some of them were sent towards Jupiter or Saturn, and they were seemed to want to. The scientists at NASA or NSA seem to want to place them in certain orbits around those planets of Saturn and Jupiter. They weren't so much as an exploratory craft. They were there to protect or notify Earth on something approaching.
Now, I did hear a rumor of a naval commander saying they had spotted a craft, I think, off of Jupiter that was 30 miles long, quote-unquote, moving under its own steam. Are you aware of any of these crafts they have spotted out there around Jupiter and Mars?
Yes, there was several launched around there. I'm not sure if the one that the naval commander is talking about is the one that we launched or if it was an extraterrestrial craft. But I knew of that program, and I knew of those. I was a counterintelligence officer trying to protect that program, Gamma Sling. It was a project name. And so I know that much about it. Now, I've heard many other rumors, and I've talked to people talking about a special or a secret space force with soldiers battling aliens, but I don't know anything about that.
Have you ever met anyone from an SSP program, and like, what did you think about that?
Yes, at Area 51, we had a special building located not too far from the OSI building. We were building 432, and they were building a 437, and it contained personnel from NASA and from NSA, from the National Security Administration, and from the National Security Agency, and their job was to monitor the technology that was being developed at Area 51 to advance this secret space program.
Rick, are you aware of any other SSP programs that are working at the same time?
Well, I've had numerous conversations with people who claim to have been in different secret space programs at UFO conventions and other places. Some of them acted quite legitimate and some of them weren't. So there could possibly be other secret space programs that I wasn't aware of. That's just highly possible.
And what other authentic UFO events can you share with us, such as the UFOs spotted over the Capitol in 1953.
Under my briefing, in 1978, getting into the program, they briefed about legitimate sightings of an unknown set of UFOs. And those UFOs, the colonel that briefed us said, were in fact extraterrestrials.
Wow.
We knew of it.
And that was the admiral that did that said that? The colonel.
Colonel that briefed us, briefed me and others into the program, he specifically said that the incident in Washington, D.C. was in fact extraterrestrial.
So if this was an actual factual event that's caught on radar, you've been told it was by your higher-ups, I mean, what action did they take? What did they feel threatened? Was there a new protocol written in place?
Well, they scrambled F-89s, which was the most advanced aircraft jet they'd had during that time period. And the F-89s just couldn't keep up with the UFOs. The UFOs disappeared, and they were chased by the F-89s. I believe there were some F-86s involved too, but they could never catch the UFOs.
Any other events that you can recall?
There was an incident that happened in 1959 at one of the Pine Tree radar sites in Canada, where a UFO crashed, and it was some distance from the radar site. There was Air Force, U.S. Air Force and Canadian Forces personnel that went out, and they had an actual encounter with an ET. The craft crashed. It was on the ground for some time. There was photographs taken, but eventually the craft was able to propel itself out of there. And ironically, in 2006 at the UFO convention at Laughlin, one of the key players in that did a presentation of that incident where he showed that picture of that craft on the ground. It's on the ground for some 6 or 8 hours. And the Canadian authorities and American authorities really didn't know what to do other than circle it, the military police. But they, somehow the craft was able to repair itself and fly out of there.
Now, you did say there was extraterrestrials on board that interacted with the humans, correct?
Yes, there was extraterrestrials that when the military authorities, the Canadian and American military forces got to the craft, it was some distance away from the radar site. It was filmed, it was tracked on radar. It went down, they knew where it went down, the Americans did, the Canadians did. They went out to it, took some time to get there. When they got there, the extraterrestrials were outside their craft, either trying to repair it or providing security or some reason outside the craft. They were in suits, almost like snow suits, with large helmets, extremely large helmets. And the pictures that were taken by the military personnel, Canadians and American military personnel, were from a distance. So you couldn't really get a good description, a depiction of what the ETs looked like. But the craft was a oval-shaped craft. It was small, wasn't very large. There were two creatures that were outside the craft, and they eventually got inside the craft and flew it away at lightning speed. So that's really all that we knew about it.
Any other briefings that stand out that you like to mention?
I think one of the incidents has never been disclosed. I've never seen it. I've never heard anybody of it. But the craft crashed in a field. It was near a football stadium or a sports stadium. Not sure if it was a football stadium. And it was just after the sporting event. There were several people that saw the craft on the ground. There were a lot of people that went over to it and saw it. But there was nobody around the craft. And the people were somewhat concerned. Apparently the local authorities, law enforcement, went out there, the fire department went out there. But the craft was situated in a manner that fooled a lot of people. It was changing shapes. And so it fooled people into thinking it wasn't anything other than whatever they were looking at. Eventually, the craft was able to propel itself out of there. Now, that craft flew right over Andrews Air Force Base, which is where the U.S. president flies out of. When he leaves Washington, D.C., there were aircraft scrambled from Andrews. Again, there were probably F-89s scrambled after this craft, But eventually the craft, they lost it over the Atlantic Ocean. That was quite an interesting story the colonel told us about that incident. And I've never seen or heard any mention of that in any kind of UFO literature since.
Amazing, amazing stuff. Rick, there's a lot of these videos online of alien autopsies. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I'm not sure if they're legitimate or not. I've seen many of them online that probably were staged. But let me tell you about one that has never been released online. This is an actual alien autopsy that was done on the Ebens that was crashed in 1947. I saw parts of that in my briefing, but later on, while I was working in intelligence, I saw the complete autopsy film, and that was legitimate.
What did you see?
It was the Eben, the small grays. It had some really catastrophic injuries to it, the body, and the pathologists that were doing the autopsy was taking a long time doing the autopsy. I think the film lasted about an hour and a half, which is probably a little bit more than a normal autopsy would last, but it was taking apart every single bone or every single tissue or every single organ that they could find in the body and analyzing it and talking about it while they're doing it, explaining that this isn't a human body. A human wouldn't have this organ here, or the skin texture wouldn't be this of a human, or the underlying epidermal of the skin wouldn't be this, and the bone. And they were explaining this all. So it's obviously watching this, it wasn't a human being that they were doing an autopsy on.
Is this in any relation to that interrogation video online of the extraterrestrial being interrogated and speaking? Is that authentic?
There are some that's online. There was one online probably 10 or 15 years ago that was pulled off online. That was legitimate. That was the same one I saw when I was at Area 51. I saw it was closed circuit. I didn't actually see it doing it. I was at another location watching it on a closed circuit camera, and it was an interrogation done on one of the ETs.
Yes. This is like a small gray, whitish.
Yes, a small gray, whitish. Yes, that was a legitimate one. Mm-hmm. Now, there's another one on that you can barely hear the interrogator, and you can barely see the extraterrestrial. I think that's staged.
You were involved with a controversial researcher, Paul Benowitz. What happened with that?
Well, I was a counterintelligence officer at Kirtland Air Force Base, and Paul Benowitz came to us with photographs and electronic signals that he had collected from Kirtland Air Force Base. Paul lived just outside the perimeter, the northeast perimeter of Kirtland Air Force Base. And he had gathered some information, electronic signals and photographs. And he came to OSI and he said, I've filmed this on your base, and I'm afraid that your base is being subjected to extraterrestrial hostile intent. Well, when he first came to us, we kind of questioned him. And so we did an investigation on him. And some of the things Paul was doing was collecting signals on a highly classified operation that was involving the National Security Administration on Kirtland. And I can talk about this now because it's been declassified. Back in the early 1980s, the NSA had perfected a laser that could travel long distances in space. And what we were doing was every time a Soviet satellite passed over Kirtland Air Force Base or in close proximity, we would shoot that laser up to the lens of the camera and blind the camera so the Russians couldn't take any pictures. And the NSA also had a facility at Area 51 that did the exact same thing. This was back in the early 80s. It was an experimental laser, but it worked. And this has been released since. There's been some information in books about it, so it's not classified anymore. But Paul was collecting data from that. So what we had to do was we had to convince Paul that what he was collecting was extraterrestrial emissions, and all those photographs that he was taking, which were of classified drone operations, that they were all UFO related. And it wasn't hard to do because Paul was a believer in UFOs. Paul had been a member of MUFON and APRO for years. So Paul believed in this stuff. So it was pretty easy for us to convince Paul that what he was seeing was UFO related.
He would believe anything you would say, of course, because you guys are the number one.
Exactly. He would believe everything. And it wasn't hard for us to do that. We would just nod. I would just nod and say, yeah, you know, I think you got something there.
You're actually encouraging him with this disinformation campaign.
Exactly. And he believed it, and we did our job. But, ironically, Paul was taking some other photographs that were not research and development crafts. Paul was a pilot. He was on a flight from Albuquerque to Chama, New Mexico.
Oh.
He was going up to Archuleta Peak near Dulce to take pictures of what was occurring up there. On his way back, he had a person in the co-pilot seat, one of his workers. As they got about over Red River in that area there, anybody from Mexico that would know
Red River,
that?
Yes.
He saw this huge craft fly over top of him. Well, his partner had a camera, so he started filming this. And this craft was hovering right above Paul's Cessna 180. And Paul took a picture of that. That wasn't our craft. We don't know where that came from. When Paul got back, he immediately called me at the office and told me, hey, Rick, you need to come down here. I got some photographs. He had his own photo lab. I took some pictures of something you need to see. So I said, okay, yeah, I'll come down there, Paul. So I went down to the office the next day, and Paul had these big, he made 8x10s. He said, you tell me what that is. And I looked at it, and I had no idea what it was. I said, where'd you take this, Paul? He said, over Red River, New Mexico. I was coming back from Dulce, and I saw this craft. He said, that is an alien extraterrestrial craft. That's the mothership, and it was a huge craft. So I said, well, let me take this back to the office and have it analyzed and try to figure out what the heck this is. So when I took it back to the office and laid it down, and all the other agents that were working on this operation said, holy cow. Well, they didn't say cow, they said something else. That's a real one. He took a picture of a real one. And so what are we gonna do now? Now, how are we gonna convince him that is a one of ours? Or if that's one of theirs? We were somewhat confused. But after that point, Paul, you couldn't convince Paul otherwise.
Right.
He was thoroughly convinced that what he was seeing, what he was taking pictures of, were UFOs. And so we just let it go at that. But we were real interested in this one picture he took. Couldn't figure out where it came from.
And he had a witness on top of it.
And he had a witness. Yep. He had a witness.
So describe this craft in the photo. I mean, you said it was really large. What other details could you tell us?
This craft probably was 100 foot in diameter at least. It was oblong. You couldn't really tell the shape because of the angle that the photograph was taken, but it looked like saucer shaped. And the ironic thing about this, it had little portals. And you could see into the portals because the craft was that close to his aircraft. And the photographer, his partner, was photographing this. You could see little creatures inside those portals. They were moving around in there. And these still photographs that he was taking, he took probably 10 or 12 over a period of maybe 15 or 20 seconds. And then the craft disappeared, it took off. And the propulsion system, another ironic thing that he photographed was arcs coming down from the bottom of the craft. And I don't know that we could figure out what they were, a propulsion system.
Right, did he say what color the arcs were?
Just
or the
white,
craft?
It was like lightning.
Lightning.
It was like lightning.
Mm-hmm. And it was hovering there as they, flew by.
Yeah, and the other ironic thing is the plane's moving. You know, Paul says he's going about 140 knots. And this craft is hovering above him, so that obviously this craft is going the same speed. Now, we asked Paul, the first thing I asked Paul was there any missing time? And were you watching your instruments to see if, in fact, you stopped? Because maybe the air, maybe. He said, no, I'm a good pilot. And he was on IFR and
sure.
VFR. And he said, no, I was still going. I looked down, I was going at 140 knots. I said, well, and that's maintained? He said, yeah, it almost touched my aircraft.
Wow.
I said, why do you think this craft came after you? He said, because I was up in the Dulce, and at that time, there were a lot of people thought that there was a secret base at Dulce, and they were flying UFOs out of it. And Paul thought of that too. Paul said, well, I was up near Dulce. I flew over Dulce, and it was chasing me out of there. That's what Paul told us.
What do you know about Dulce?
Well, Dulce is an interesting place. I know there's a lot of stories about Dulce and the war that allegedly occurred down there, and a particular person that came on YouTube and made a video about it that was missing a finger and so forth. But there's a lot of questions about what was happening in Dulce. And I didn't know at the time what was happening up there. So I went up there with Paul a couple different times, and I saw strange things happening. Eventually, I started looking within the intelligence community to find out, hey, does anybody within the intelligence community know about this? When I checked with Army Intelligence at Fort Carson, Colorado, they told me, well, we can tell you, but we got to be in person, and you're going to have to get this and this and this ticket punched. So I got all those tickets punched. I went up to Fort Carson, Army Intel, G2, and I sat down, and they explained me what was going on at Dulce. It was a special forces training base. And the lights, the strange lights that we were seeing, were lights that were built into the ground, and they were navigation lights for helicopters coming in. They'd turn these lights on, and the helicopter would come in to follow these lights. And there was other navigational aids up there, a TACAN and other things, which is a tactical air navigation system. And that answered about 90% of my questions about where all these strange things were. Why did they see these strange lights? Well, there were navigation lights. And so that answered it. But there was some...
Could they be giving you disinformation, right?
No, because we went up there when they told me when the next operation was going to be. It was going to be the 160th, which was a Special Forces flight unit, and a Delta Force team that was going to train up there on a certain date. And I believe it was 1980, maybe latter part of 79, I'm not sure, or maybe even 81. Anyways, we went up there, and we saw it. We witnessed it. Now, that part of it answered it. Now, was there something else that the Army was hiding? That's a possibility.
Well, Paul did see something, you know, just a few hundred miles away there.
Exactly.
So that raises a lot of questions that, who knows?
That's a possibility. I always question other intelligence agencies when they tell you, because you always know they're not telling you everything.
That's right.
They tell you what you want to hear, but they're not telling you everything you want to hear.
That's right. Absolutely. I totally believe that. I was once told everything you see and do down here, 5% of it is completely disinformation and false, just to keep you in check.
That's true. Because I was on the side of the disinformation.
So how do we know you're not disinforming us right now, Rick?
Well, I've been out a long time, and I can prove I have documents and other ways of verifying what I'm saying. I have no reason now to disinform anyone. I'm not involved in a disinformation campaign with the Central Intelligence Agency or DIA or OSI, like a lot of people are saying right now. I'm on my own. I do my own thing. I tell the truth. What I don't know, I won't say. Or I'll tell you I don't know it. But I'll tell you, what I say is factual.
How do you determine what people and information needs to be discredited?
Well, it's done by, not me personally, it's done by our organization. We find a person that might have some information about a classified operation or a classified project, or might have come up on as some kind of a classified vehicle. They're reported, the information is gathered, and then somebody above me determines that we need to perform a disinformation, we call it counterintelligence operation, disinform a person, that person, because they just had access to classified, highly classified material. Now, we're not going to do an operation on anything other than top secret, highly classified material. People had access to minor stuff like confidential or secret. We're not going to do that unless it's some kind of a special case. When it comes to nuclear weapons, we might do it. But anything else, we wouldn't do it unless it was highly classified. And most of the operations that we ran to disinform somebody was because they had access to highly classified information, such as a research and development aircraft that they saw fly over or land or some kind of technology that we were working on that has to remain secret. Now, remember back in the 80s, we had the Russians that were breathing down our neck, and they were after everything they could get their hands onto. So we had to protect the national security. And the only way to do that is if somebody had access to national security and they weren't authorized to, we had to disinform them. And we did that, and we did it in a professional manner.
Did you have any moles, you know, in your agency?
Yeah, we did. We had one or two during our time with OSI. We had one particular mole that we caught, and they prosecuted him. Our integrity was pretty high within OSI.
Now, there was an incident at Bowling Air Force Base with some of these tall white Nordics with some military officers. Could you tell us anything about that?
This was a horrible incident that happened at Bowling Air Force Base in the 80s. A group of officers, general officers, colonels, and I think a couple of generals were in a meeting in a secure area of Bowling Air Force Base. And they weren't discussing anything to do with UFOs. They were just there talking about highly classified other projects. When suddenly these strange-looking creatures came through the walls, as told by a couple of the survivors, and they started mutilating and attacking these general officers. Several of their officers suffered very serious injuries, and some of them died. They were after the equipment that was in this room. And the strange thing about it, the equipment they were after was overhead viewers and things like that, a slide presentation machine, and a 60-millimeter projector. And nobody seemed to know why and why they would want those items. But these officers were mutilated. Some of them had a...
In what way? Through hand-to-hand combat, or
they were
weapons?
Attacking him with their own hands. They were putting the aliens were putting their hands through the bodies. They were tearing off limbs. There was one lieutenant colonel who lost both arms. There was a general that suffered severe injuries that caused him to be paralyzed, so he had to be medically discharged. There were others. Now there were security forces there. Air Force police, called security police, were there, and they came in when the security police came. They weren't in the room, the security police. They were on the outside of the room,
right?
Because they weren't cleared. But when they got into the room, the entities, these creatures, the Nordics, left.
Did the security police witness this?
The security police didn't actually witness the attack, but they obviously witnessed the injuries that weren't caused by anybody in the room. I mean, these are catastrophic injuries. You can't rip off an arm. A human can't rip off an arm or rip off their own arm. And these arms, I think there was a leg or an ankle or something that was ripped off. Doctors said later that somebody with a huge amount of force would have to rip off an arm from the shoulder. And so I don't believe any of the security forces actually saw it happen. But there were there were other people that weren't injured in the room. There was a master sergeant that was the projector operator, and there was some other people. There were enlisted people in the room that were aides or something. They weren't injured. It was just the officers that were injured.
So they watched this. Did they get any film of this going on?
No, I don't believe there was any film.
So there was how many survivors?
I think there was 8 survivors.
Out of 12?
8 or 9 survivors. I think 2 died and the rest survived. I believe one died sometime later, but I don't know the exact numbers. I don't remember the exact numbers. OSI from Andrews Air Force Base went over there and investigated this, and that was really highly classified. I believe it still is classified. I haven't heard. I heard one other person mentioning this story, and that was Wendell Stevens, the late Wendell Stevens, who was a prominent figure within the UFO community that would speak at most all UFO conferences in Laughlin or other places in the United States. Wendell had more details about it because Wendell actually interviewed one of the survivors.
Oh, wow.
Who was a lieutenant colonel.
And what did he say?
Lieutenant colonel said that he told a story of these creatures just came through the wall. And everybody, obviously, if you're sitting there at some kind of a meeting and you see creatures coming through the wall that would stun you. Everyone was stunned, thinking it was some sort of a hallucination or something.
Right.
And then these creatures started attacking these officers. And now some of the enlisted people tried to stop it, tried to step in. By the time the security forces got in there, it was over with. The whole attack didn't last more than 3 or 4 minutes.
Wow, how horrific. Now, has this ever been answered by the Nordic ET race since then? Did they ever take responsibility for this?
No, I don't know that. I wouldn't have known. I wouldn't know that. But I know that after this incident, the Nordics were declared to be hostile, and they were blood and gut people. I mean, entities. So you could kill them. You could shoot them and kill them. So I don't know if there was a shoot on sight order or anything like that. But I know they were declared to be hostile. And
they're obviously using some sort of portal technology to come in and leave at their own.
Yeah, were they teleported in? I mean, that was a lot of questions weren't answered. How did they get in? They didn't come through the wall.
Or could have been a diversion, too. They might have been doing something else on the base.
That's true.
You know.
That's possible.
Are there any other field investigations you'd like to share with the audience?
Yes, one particular one. It was while I was conducting the operation against Paul Benowitz that we came upon a woman by the name of Myrna Hansen. Myrna came to us. She was recommended. They recommended she see a government agent regarding her experiences. And I interviewed Myrna Hansen, and she told me she had been abducted by ETs.
Do you know the types of aliens she was interacting with?
The Greys.
The Greys.
Yeah, she described them as small, 3 to 4 foot ETs with large eyes, small noses, small mouths. They didn't talk to her. It was all telepathic. It was the typical Greys.
Right.
She told me this wild story over a period of several hours. She was a woman, had a very little education. She had a son. She was driving from Angel Fire, New Mexico, to Eagle Nest, New Mexico. And she lost time. She missed a lot of time, 10 or 12 hours. And she found herself along Eagle Nest Lake with her son, her 7-year-old son.
Hmm.
And her car, she couldn't find it. Eventually, state police found the vehicle someplace, and she got the vehicle back, and she came back to Albuquerque, and she talked to several people, including Paul Benowitz. Paul Benowitz's secretary was her friend, her mother's friend, excuse me. So the mother got in touch with Paul, thinking that he might know where she could go with this, and then Paul then referred it to us. Anyways, I interviewed her. She told us a story about being taken to this underground facility. She went down, she didn't know how many feet, maybe 100 feet. She described this circular area with a ladder, a portal to her right or left, and a concrete, all concrete. While she was telling me this, I knew exactly what she was describing. She was describing out in Coyote Canyon, which was a test site for Kirtland Air Force Base. There was a research and development. They were making a bunker for nuclear weapons, experimenting with different type of ways to store nuclear weapons. This particular place that she was describing was located out of Coyote Canyon. It was a concrete structure that went down about 60 feet. And the idea was to store a nuclear weapon, put a nuclear weapon inside, and shut the front door. The nuclear weapon would drop down 60 feet, they'd cover it up, so the nuclear weapon was hidden. So
right.
If terrorists broke into the structure, they couldn't find the nuclear weapon. She described this perfectly. I mean, absolutely perfectly. But she told us this portal to her left, she opened it, and there were vats, many vats, she couldn't explain how many, with human bodies in them. And she was taken to one of them. Well, when she was explaining this to me, I started asking her, do you have a boyfriend that's in the military? Have you ever been at Kirtland Air Force Base? Has your parents ever been in the military? So on. No, never been to Kirtland, never been out there, don't know anything about the base. And so I thought, how would she know this? So I went out there to the base, went to the structure, I went down there. The only thing she had wrong that I couldn't find was any portals. I mean, there was a door that you could open up mm-hmm. with the right key to open, and there was an escape hatch. But that's the only thing I could find, and there wasn't any vats with human bodies in it. I re-interviewed her several different times, asking about her experiences. And she told me the exact same story over and over again. If a person's lying,
they're gonna slip up. Yeah.
When you ask them a story and they're lying, they're gonna slip up. And so then we decided to do a polygraph examination on her. So we got our polygraph examination, and we have the best, probably the best polygraph examiners in the federal government. And they do this, they call it the counterintelligence type of a polygraph, where they tell you, they hook you up and they tell you, I'm gonna ask you questions. I want you to say no to every one of these questions. And then the next strip, they're gonna say, I want you to answer yes to every one of these questions. And the third time around, I want you to tell me the truth, yes or no. And you can't beat that. I don't care who you are. And I know because we had to take those polygraphs.
Right, that's right.
And you can't beat it. There's no way you can beat this. And she passed it. There's no deception whatsoever indicated. They do it by numbers. The higher the number, plus numbers, the higher indication that you might be deceptive. She was a -5, meaning she was as truthful as you could possibly be. The Pope couldn't have done better than that.
How did she recall this? Was it like mind control? Did the ET show her something of how it is in modern day or what it might be in the future down there?
Well, after the polygraph, we wanted to give her a hypnotic interview where we have our own psychologist.
You were taking it serious.
We took it serious. My supervisor, he suggested it to me, and I said, why are we doing this?
Breach of security.
You know, she doesn't know anything. Maybe she had some kind of experience. Maybe it was something to do with a mind that somebody planted that in her mind. Maybe the ETs planted it in her mind. Nope. My supervisor said, we're going to do a hypnotic interview on it. It's okay. So we set it up, brought the psychiatrist in. He does a hypnotic interview, regressed her back. She repeated exactly the same thing.
Amazing.
Didn't deviate one iota from what she originally told me.
Oh, I love it.
And now we have this third measure that we used in very, 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 very rare circumstances. We can actually do a polygraph on a person's subconscious mind. We put them under hypnosis and we give them a polygraph. This time we just ask them a yes or no. We did that. And that was an amazing response because the polygrapher that was doing it said, I don't think this is going to work. We've done it before, known as spies and people like that.
Right.
I don't think this is going to work, he said. But, you know, he interviewed her and he got with a psychiatrist and finally put her under.
So they did medicate her for this?
They had to medicate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
And same thing, told us the exact same story.
Oh, fantastic.
So now what am I supposed to think? Here I'm the case agent. What am I going to just think about it? Everybody's telling me she's telling the truth, so I have to go with the fact that she's telling the truth. Everything she says is truthful. How did the ETs get out there? How did the ETs create this? And why isn't there these vats? Why can't we find these vats with these human bodies in it? Can't ever find out. So what we did was we took care of her. We paid for her medical. We gave her access to the VA facility, or the government facility. We fill out our prescriptions for her. We actually bought her a trailer. We bought her a
nice
trailer and placed her and her son in there. And we gave her some money. So she eventually got a job. And I kept contact with her over the years. She eventually moved to Texas. She had relatives in Texas. She eventually moved to Texas.
So what else did you learn from her? And how did you close out that case? I mean, what did you write to the commander?
Well, we learned a lot of things from her. We learned, number one, that a lot of our techniques actually worked. Hypnosis, the polygraphs, the hypnotic polygraph, all these things worked. And that she was truthful. in her experience, we were, I mean, we she proved without a shadow of a doubt that what she told us was truth. But how can it be the truth? What happened to her mind? Who planted that in her mind? There were so many questions that we had that weren't answered, that we had no way of answering. And even though we talked to her many times afterwards, she couldn't explain her experience. She didn't know why they took her there. And was it a facsimile place that it looked like where we were, where our place was, but maybe it was at some other location that the aliens created? You know, it got complex. It got really, really, really complex. And so I closed it out by saying I believed her. What she told us was the truth. And really, there isn't any other counterintelligence aspect of this case.
Rick, once again, fascinating information. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
You're very welcome.
I'm Emery Smith, and this is Cosmic Disclosure. Until next time.
Now, I'm going to give you some background information on Richard Doughty. This is from HuffPost. Ex-Air Force law enforcement agent says he's hoaxed major UFO mythologies. I'm going to read this from you. I have been researching UFOs for many years, delving deep into the underbelly of UFO lore, and one name seems to frequently pop up. His name is Richard Doughty, and in the 1980s, he was a special agent for the U.S. Air Force Special Investigations, AFOSI, stationed at Kirkland Air Force Base in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He claims that while he was there, he was tasked with hoaxing documents and feeding false information to UFO researchers. The U.S. Air Force refuses to comment on whether they knew of his activities and whether his claims of partaking in this activity at the behest of his superiors are accurate. It wouldn't be so bad if his stories of UFO crashes and secret UFO management groups, such as the fabled MJ-12, were not subject of a large amount of books, movies, video games, television shows, and who knows what else. He says he even acted as a consultant for the X-Files, which is one of the very few tall tales of his that might actually be true. Doughty's story has changed over the years, and some of the details of the stories are conflicting. In frustration with this whole situation, I decided to send the Air Force Freedom of Information Act request to find out more. I also wanted an official response regarding whether he ordered to create these hoax documents. At first, the AFOSI public affairs chief was very helpful. She expedited my request, and I received some very interesting documents. I was told that when my FOIA request was fulfilled, she would help me find someone I could talk to for an official statement. However, once I got the documents, she would no longer talk to me. What was in the documents was very interesting and corroborated some of the legend around the Doughty affair. Story begins with a man called Paul Benowitz, who owned a humidity equipment company with contracts with Kirkland Air Force Base. His house and office were near Kirkland, and he believed he was seeing UFOs over a part of the base that housed nuclear weapons. He also believed he was receiving transmissions from the aliens that flew those UFOs. Surprisingly, the U.S. Air Force humored him and sent Doughty and an officer to investigate. But the Air Force Office of Special Investigations decided that further investigation was unwarranted. A few days later, Benowitz was allowed to present his evidence to some of the officers and scientists at the base. He wanted a grant to conduct more research, and one of the scientists said he would help Benowitz fill out the paperwork for a grant. The documents also state that two U.S. senators from New Mexico had called or shown up at Kirkland to check on the Air Force Special Investigations investigation of Benowitz and his ET contacts. Apparently, Benowitz had sought their help. Both times, the senators were told there was no investigation. Doughty claims what the senators were told was not true. Doughty says he was told to make Benowitz believe there was an impending alien invasion because Benowitz was actually observing secret Air Force projects. According to Doughty, the Air Force wanted to discredit Benowitz so no one would figure that out. However, Doughty claimed that in doing so, he created hoax documents that were given to Benowitz and other UFO researchers, and that he broke into Benowitz's house and office, some of which is illegal. I'd say so. Yeah, you can't just break into people's shit. I have been able to confirm that Doughty did give Benowitz documents that would make him believe he was under investigation, even though Doughty told both senators that his was not the case. Benowitz eventually checked into a mental health facility due to paranoia. Doughty was successful, and Benowitz was convinced of the imminent alien invasion. This entire affair is incredibly unscrupulous, and Doughty claims he did it all under orders.
Dottie is now a sergeant with the New Mexico State Police in Grants. I think the Air Force needs to respond to Dottie's claims. I have drafted a letter that is sent to the Air Force for a response. I have yet to receive one. I have posted this letter online with extensive references to my sources and the Freedom of Information Act documents I received. Take a look and let me know if you agree that the Air Force needs to address this situation once and for all. Now, this is HuffPost. As a contributor, Alejandro Rojas, writer, blogger, video, and podcast host. So he looked into it. Multiple people looked into it. That was back in 2014 that HuffPost looked into Dottie. And, I mean, they're pulling up shit saying that he did what he said he did. So he's legit. He was in it. All I can think of is there's one of two reasons that this is going on. Either one, they don't have UFOs and they're just making you think they have UFOs because they just want to, you know, do the whole switcheroo, which doesn't really make sense to me. Like, why would you say that there's UFOs when there's not? Even if you're trying to protect some secret organization or secret experimentation or something like that, like, can you just say is an experimental drone? Be like, oh, well, you saw a classified drone, is what it was. Like that, but instead saying, oh well, no, it was UFOs, man. I mean, that doesn't make much sense to me. Why that would be the way they would go, but I don't know. But he says they're legit. I mean, it's an open secret. It's an open secret with the government. Is that there are aliens? You know, it's kind of like, you know, the slut at the office. You know, everyone knows, but she'll deny it if you ask her. You know, that's what the government is, the slut at the office. So, I don't know. A lot of stuff he was talking about like that. I mean, can you imagine if we're already on Mars? If we're already at these places that we're trying to get to? I mean, it's when this story finally breaks and people find out what the government has been into and that we're already so far advanced than what we're being led to believe right now and that we've got technology that, you know, can solve the income inequality and we have technology that's going to solve climate change and we're still fucking with gas engines. We're still fucking with burning shit to make power. There's other options out there. I'm looking at all these different technologies that are supposed to replace carbon fuel. No more coal, no more none of this stuff. I mean, they just came out with a new nuclear reactor that's smaller and is more, I should say, is safer to be used because the radioactive material can't be used to make weapons. You know, if you have a meltdown, it's not going to be that bad. It's just, there's so much more that we can do, and the government is just keeping everything under wraps, letting us burn our world to the ground. Like I said, I think we're trading water. I think we're selling water to the aliens. There's not a lot of places in the universe where liquid water can exist. You know, you see all these UFOs over oceans. I think they're coming down, grabbing water, taking it. I don't know if they're stealing it or if they're taking it so that way, you know, when the ice melts, our oceans don't get too big. Because, you know, they've been saying that we're going to be underwater 10 years from now. Remember Al Gore when he said that, you know, 10 years from now, we're going to be underwater. Manhattan's going to be gone. What if that was true? What if that was the case? And then, you know, we talked about, hey, listen, we got a serious problem down here. We're going to start getting flooding and whatnot. And maybe this will keep from destroying our cities, you know, like California and New York and Florida, or states, I should say. One thing I was looking at for Florida, man, it's, you can't go too high with the ocean rise on Florida because there's a lot of people who live right on the coast. I live in Florida. I'm over in Central Florida near Tampa, and you go around to some of these places and they're right on the water. If we had seen a rise in sea level, we would definitely be noticing it because there'd be a lot of houses underwater right now. And we're not seeing it. So either they lied, they didn't know what they were talking about, or we're getting help elsewhere. I think we're getting help elsewhere. Because they also, the aliens also go to nuclear sites. And those nuclear sites, I've heard multiple people say that they're able to control the nukes. They can turn them on, they can turn them off. If we launch them, they can stop them. I've heard of nukes being intercepted. You know, when they were testing ballistic missiles, they were testing one. They were going to launch a nuke into space and detonate it. And a craft came up to it, hit it with a beam of light, and the warhead popped off and fell. So, I mean, it could be that they're trying to save us. You know, we're just exploding in technology, not caring about what happens. I mean, when they first detonated a nuclear bomb, they didn't know it wasn't going to ignite the atmosphere. They were like, fuck it, let's see what happens. That's some dangerous thinking right there. Like, you know, hey, we don't know what's going to do, but let's hope for the best. Like, that's some scary shit, you know, because they could turn on something that we wouldn't even know it. Oh, just 1 second, half the country is gone. And we're like, what the hell happened? Oh, well, they turned on something they shouldn't have. But that's life on this planet, isn't it? You know? It's crazy. Oh, well. Thanks for listening. I hope you guys enjoyed. Listen to ads. Help me out. You know, if you've got a podcast, hit me up. I'll listen to yours. You know, I think we need to help each other out in this podcast world. We're going to have to do something when the AI takes all our jobs. You know, maybe one day we'll get into a spot where we'll get paid to create. You know, that would be nice. You know, everyone gets a check, a universal basic income. Everyone gets a check. And we could just do podcasts or videos or just be creative and, you know, interact that way and get paid for it. I think that'd be awesome. But we'll see. The next few years are going to be rough. So I wish everyone the best. You know, one thing that the AI can't take over, trade jobs. So if you're looking to switch careers, look into a trade school, become a plumber, an electrician, a mason, something that you can do with your hands, because AI is not going to have that dexterity for a little while. You know, you're not going to, you know, call a robot plumber to your house. You know, you're going to call a person because you want to know that they can get it done right. At least for a while, until the robots become good enough that, you know, they could do what we do and 10 times better. But that would be my recommendation. Stock up on things that you can trade for barter in case our financial system goes down. Salt's a good one because we need salt. It's a food preservative. People are going to need it. It's cheap. You can stockpile it. I currently got like 40 cans or those little cylinders of salt. You know, just in case shit goes down, I've got stuff I can trade off to people. You know, there's other stuff you can get. You know, MREs are good. MREs are, you know, ammo. If you can get ammo, I heard that they're going to be trying to pass a law. This just came out. They're just trying to pass a law that going to restrict ammo sales. So if you can buy ammo, I know it's hard to find right now, but if you can invest in it, ammo is going to be worth its weight in gold here soon, I'm betting. We're probably going to see a huge financial collapse. I don't know. It's all bad. Fuck it. It's not the worst, though. At least we're not killing each other yet. You know, you always got to look at the bright side. That's always right around the corner. So until next time, be safe, be well.